everybody. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. This week on Indirect Democracy, we're going to be taking a look at the Mark Foley scandal. We'll be covering the electronic voting machine article by Bob Kennedy in this week's issue of Rolling Stone. We'll also be having a global warming update. Of course, we'll be looking at the presidential horoscope. We have a new sponsor. And of course, we'll have our What a Weenie Award. So welcome. Welcome back. Podcast number 6 of Indirect Democracy. And I want to thank you. Thank you really from the bottom of my heart if you are listening to the 6th podcast of this show. I appreciate it. My name is David. I am your host. And this is Indirect Democracy, as I have already said, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. And although I have failed to mention it in the past, I hope that by going to the website, you have seen that there is a contact screen, and that is david@indirectdemocracy.com. I encourage you to write if you have any questions or comments about the show. Maybe even so much as if you have any suggestions for the What a Weenie Award. If you feel like writing with some ideas, maybe even want to contribute, I'd be glad to read it. And, of course, give all the credit that credit is due if you decide that you want to contribute to the show. See, it's been a heck of a week. What a week. Oh, my goodness. You know, it's one of those things that you sit back and sit back in awe and go, was this the October surprise? Was this what everybody was talking about? Did anybody have any idea that after everything that happened on 9/11 and the Congress basically bowing down to the president and giving him the torture law that he wanted, that all of that would be forgotten in basically a 72-hour span with the resignation of Mark Foley, the Bob Woodward book, and so many things that just happened that you sit back and you go, whoa, I can't believe that the Republicans have a chance of winning, but we're going to cover that later because there is still that possibility that exists. But I would be remiss. I would be forlorn. I would be lost in a jungle if I did not give you your global warming update. And this one is news because the Supreme Court has gone back into session. The first Monday in October has passed. This is from a news site called Platts.com. I'll have the link up, as I always do, to as much stories as I can get. And before I start with this global warming update, I apologize if there were certain dates that I messed up on the list for the What a Weenie Award I gave to about Senator Frist. The dates were correct. I know I got a couple of the years wrong. I apologize for that. If you do go to the site, you'll be able to check out those links and get the correct dates. I owe you an apology as my listener for getting those dates wrong, and will work harder to make sure that I do not get even the smallest of details wrong. You know, sometimes you try hard and you do make mistakes, so please forgive. And like I said, if you're still listening, I appreciate it. So going back, this is from Platts.com. The article is entitled, U.S. Supreme Court Sets Date for Global Warming Case Oral Arguments. And I quote, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday set a date of November 29th for oral arguments in a global warming case it agreed to hear earlier in 2006. The plaintiffs in the case, a coalition of states and environmental groups, believe the federal government is obligated under the Clean Air Act to regulate emissions of carbon dioxide and other so-called greenhouse gases in order to combat global warming. The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, is the named defendant in the case. It argues, however, that the Clean Air Act, or CAA, does not authorize it to regulate the gases as pollutants as the states and environmental groups claim it is. The EPA also argues it would choose not to regulate the emissions as a matter of policy, even if it did have the authority to do so. This case began in 1999 during the Clinton administration, when the states formally petitioned the EPA to regulate vehicular greenhouse gas emissions. The EPA may well have done so at that point, because the agency's general counsel had authored a legal opinion the previous year concluding that CO2 was indeed an air pollutant that could be regulated under the Clean Air Act. With that as a backdrop, the EPA launched a lengthy process to consider the state's petitions, and this process was still underway when the Bush administration assumed power in January of 2001. In September of 2003, the EPA announced that it would not grant the state's petition to regulate the emissions. As part of that decision, the EPA rescinded the previous Clinton-era opinion that had designated CO2 as a pollutant. Well, as you can imagine, and I'm not going to read the rest of the story, that's going to end this part of the quote. Of course, the states automatically appealed, and they appealed to a lower circuit court, and it has now been taken up to the Supreme Court, because as many experts believe, it's CO2 gas is a pollutant that does lead to greenhouse gases, which of course are a major cause of global warming. And as this story progresses, I will keep you up to date as to what occurs. I'll keep a watch out on November 29th, see if I can get you some of those arguments, and when the final ruling comes down, let you know what's going on with that. A couple of other quick little global warming stories that I just found fascinating. These were just little opinion pieces, and I'll have the links up, but they just made me laugh. One was called, "Did Al Gore Say Cigarette Smoking Causes Global Warming?" I'm pretty sure this is a little blog thing. It's from politicalcortex.com, and I never heard of them. I just found it funny. And I'm going to read this little quote. "Is that good enough to appease the right-wing ditto heads who have decided to now add another soundbite to their repertoire against Al Gore? Whether he said that or not at the UN, or in what context it may have been said, if it was said, anyone with any knowledge of science knows that cigarettes emit poisonous and toxic gases such as benzene, carbon monoxide, as well as methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. Unfortunately, many of those smoking them are too ignorant to know what they are putting into their own bodies and other bodies with their secondhand smoke that kills 30,000 non-smokers a year, let alone what they put into the atmosphere." It was just a fun little story because, you know, it just goes to show you what people will say. Even if I'm unaware of this, I just found out about this story recently. This article is dated October 3rd, 2006. It's just amazing how far people will go to say that this does not exist. To say that, you know, to bring up the menial and say cigarette smoking causes global warming, which obviously is not the point. And then from this one from the Australian magazine, which states that, and this was the title of the article from the Australian, "Global Warming is No Commie Plot." And the writer for this one continues to write, "If Mr. Gore is only half right, we still face the greatest threat in human history. And if the skeptics, wow, already having a hard time reading. And if the skeptics are even half wrong, they're condemning our planet to a lingering death. On the right of politics, what passes for risk assessment seems surreal. You probably know that many climate change skeptics among the commentariat are the greatest enthusiasts for the war against terror, demanding extremism in the face of comparatively small risk, while branding Gore an extremist for calling the world's attention to what may prove to be the ultimate calamity." And you know, that's part of why I do the global warming update every week, and that is just to spread the word, spread the knowledge. Because little by little, we have to always remember that this is a very real threat. As real and even more dangerous than the types of threats we worry about every day and are pushed in front of our face, i.e. terrorism, which I'm not downgrading terrorism, it's a very real threat too. But the health of our planet, the health of our lives, the way our world will be in 50 years or less are very much at stake and should never be, you know, disregarded as something that isn't real. And if you hear messages like that from anybody you talk to, point them to climatecrisis.com. You know, if you want to, point them to this website. Show them the evidence from the archives for podcast number one about greenhouse gases and global warming. I encourage it as often as possible because little by little we have to change our mindsets and have to do everything we can to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases and global warming that is occurring. So, now that I've gotten off my pedestal about that, I believe it is now time, because we didn't do this last week, to read you the President's Horoscope. And here is our weekly horoscope, and as we all know, our President is in fact a Cancer, and here is his career weekly horoscope for the week of October 1st, 2006, from the pages of Elle magazine. His meter reading is an 8. October 2nd through the 8th. Creatively, you're a maestro powerhouse. Your creativity seems directly connected to your emotions and sensuality. So if you're in love or lust, your creativity automatically peaks. But you're no hormonally crazed zombie either. You want solid guarantees, agreements, and guidelines. You want documented commitments from people before you release any of your work to them. This week is very powerful and could dramatically change your title, status, or position for the better. You'll feel pressure building all the way through Friday due to a critically important deadline drawing near. This week's touchstones are smoky quartz and petersite. I still don't know what petersite is, and how many of you are feeling just a little bit icky, just a little bit weird as I was reading that to you? Because as I was reading it, woof, going, no, I don't want the president to do. He's hormonally crazed. Woof. But speaking of hormonally crazed, and I honestly kept thinking to myself, maybe I shouldn't talk about this. Maybe I shouldn't even give it the time of day. But I can't. It's too big a story. It's too impossible not to talk about. And that is the scandal involving former representative, Republican Mark Foley. Now, I'm pretty sure most of you are aware of this story, but just in case, if there's anybody out there who is not aware, Mark Foley was a former member of the House of Representatives, and on September 29th, 2006, Mark Foley was forced to resign his position because ABC News had discovered that he had been sending sexually suggestive emails to his former pages. And these pages are part of the Congressional Page Program. It's been around for many number of years and is basically staffed by underage males and females who run errands for members of the House of Representatives. And I'm not sure, but I also believe the Senate. And it's about 100 a year that they hire. And these staff members, or these pages, actually have a dormitory that they're assigned to, and they're usually, I still believe, they're highly protected and highly monitored to make sure that they're kept safe because of a scandal that broke through in 1983 involving former House of Representative pages and other congressional pages. That's another story. If you want to look that up, I'll put a little link to that story so you can read it. We try to be fair here. It did involve both a Republican and a Democrat, so we'll try to be fair about that particular piece of history. I could read you some of these links, but, you know, how about I let you hear some of them for yourselves? And I'm trying to get to this thing. Hold on. Here it is.
They say he used the screen name MAF54 on these messages provided to ABC News. You in your boxers, too? Nope, just got home. I had a college interview that went late. Well, strip down and get relaxed. Another message. What you wearing? T-shirt and shorts. Love to slip them off of you. And this one. Do I make you a little horny? A little. Cool. Everybody wants you, if you say so. I do. You like being the only one? Of course. Less competition. On another message. You're horny, though. Well, yeah, a bit. But I'm still a virgin.
You know, it's primarily important to play those first because you have to look at his career to understand what makes them so tragically sad and somehow I don't want to say anybody should reel in anybody's type of misfortune like this because there are people involved, families, these young men. There's a lot more involved than what's really being said. So I'm not trying to take any glee in this, but there is a sick irony that's involved because here are some of the legislative things that Mark Foley did while he was in the House of Representatives. In the House, Foley was one of the foremost opponents of child pornography. He served as the chairman of the House Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children. He introduced a bill in 2002 to outlaw websites featuring sexually suggestive images of preteen children, saying that these websites are nothing more than a fix for pedophiles. As it was written, the bill would have prohibited commercial photography of children, and it failed due to the unmanageable burden it would have presented to the legitimate entertainment industry. In June of 2003, he wrote letters to the governor and attorney general of Florida, asking them to review the legality of a program for teenagers of a Lake Como nudist resort in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Foley's legislation to change federal sex offender laws was supported by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, America's Most Wanted host John Walsh, and a number of victims' rights groups. President Bush signed it into law as part of the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006. Foley also succeeded in getting a law passed that allows volunteer youth-serving organizations like the Boy Scouts of America and Boys and Girls Clubs to have access to FBI fingerprint checks to help protect children. So here we have a man who has worked hard in the Congress to get laws passed to protect children, and right now he is under investigation for inappropriate behavior with minors. Now, I say the word minors because it is an issue, and I will get into this issue in just a little bit, because the congressional pages that he has dealt with, his former congressional pages, are of the ages of 16 and 70, teenagers and, for the most part, young men, but because they are under the age of 18, they are mostly considered minors. And I will get into the discussion of the age of consent, because I think it's worth talking about, but I'm going to leave that for later when I talk about how this particular scandal is being handled by conservatives and right-wingers. So, let's see, where were we? Ah, yes, talking about this particular things that have been occurring. Let's see, you know, there are also more that I should include. Let's see, I want to make sure I get these read down. I'm going to include different links to these stories, of course, and they'll be from ABC News. And one of them includes a site where Representative Foley interrupted his vote on the House, and it was for a wartime appropriation bill to engage in internet sex with a former page. And here is some of what was stated in the story. The title of the story, New Foley Instant Messages, includes excerpts where he states, let's see, this exchange continues in which Foley and the teen both appear to describe having sexual orgasms. And, of course, his Foley's screen name was MAF54. Okay, I'd better go. Did you know you would have this effect on me? The teen, LOL, laughing out loud, I guessed. Yeah, go vote. I don't want to keep you from doing your job. Foley, can I have a kiss goodnight? Teen gives the little emoticon for a kiss, and there's that one. Then here's this exchange. Teen, are you going to be in town over the Veterans Day weekend? Foley, I may be now that you're coming. Who you coming to visit? Teen, good stuff. No one really. Foley, we will be adjourned by then. Teen, oh good. Foley, then we can have a few drinks, laughing out loud. Teen, yes, yes. Foley, you're not old enough to drink. Teen, shh. Foley, okay. Teen, that's not what my ID says. Teen, laughing out loud. Foley, okay. Teen, I probably shouldn't be telling you that, huh? Foley, we may need to drink at my house so we don't get busted. I know what a lot of people are saying and thinking, because I think everybody is saying and thinking it's, this goes to abuse of power, this possibly goes to pedophilia, and the fact that these are minors. Now, I know a lot of people believe that pedophilia deals with prepubescent children, and, you know, that's worth accepting as an argument, but we are still talking about minors. Hold on for one moment. As well, there was a story in Newsweek magazine where some of these exchanges, included Foley telling a teenager, you need a massage. And let me see. Let me get these right. This was the one that really caught me. Others show Foley under the sign name of MAF54 engaged in graphic internet sex with minors. During one session, a page of instant messages, Foley writes, to Foley, BRB, my mom is yelling. That's just terrible. I don't care what language you put it in, but if the language or the discussion you're having with anybody includes, you know, you're talking about this, and if you're a 52-year-old adult, and the response back from anybody is, my mom is yelling, and that interrupts your discussion with somebody, just from a basic point of view, maybe that's not the conversation you should be having with anybody. That's just me. But what has been mostly, and I should actually bring this up as well, currently, the FBI is investigating this issue, since it's very possible that Foley possibly broke some of the laws that he helped pass by soliciting minors to engage in sexual activity. And in thinking about it, what makes this case, you know, far more interesting than the average scandal, and like I said, I'm not trying to be glib about this, or suppressive, as Tom Cruise might say, and it's not just the obvious question of the relationship that the 52-year-old man is having with former staffers who are teenagers. You know, as I mentioned, this type of scandal has occurred, and it occurred back in 83. It was right for him to resign, and any possible criminal investigation would be more than just. I think the more important thing to discuss about this are the actions of the members of the Congressional Page Committee, including Representative John Shimkus of Illinois, Republican, Representative Shelley Capito of Virginia, a Republican, and Representative Dale Kildee of Michigan, who's a Democrat. And also at the top of that list, I cannot forget to mention Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert, Republican, and Congressman Tom Reynolds, Republican, who is chairman of the National Republican Congressional Committee, whose top aide is Kirk Fordham, who also used to be, you know, Mark Foley's aide back in the 90s. I mention these people because as early as August of 2005, Representative Shimkus was informed of these emails by a 16-year-old former Page member of Congressman Foley's office, who was from Louisiana, and he turned over these emails, which were described by members of the Republican leadership as overly friendly. And this included Congressman Foley asking for a photo of this particular 16-year-old. I imagine he might be 17 by now, but at the time he was 16. Now, although they have stated that these emails were not, sexual, they have described them as overly friendly. And it caught me off guard to ask, why is a sitting member of the United States House of Representatives asking a teenager personally on his own personal email for a photo of himself? You know, I had heard at one point, and I apologize, I don't have the link for this, that it was part of keeping track and records of the page members that work for them so the staff can remember who it is that works there, and they can write proper letters of recommendation if necessary. And that sounds like a logical explanation, but isn't that something that a staffer in your office, if you were a congressman, would do, and not that a congressman would do individually to a 16-year-old? It's just from the get-go, it sounds, you know, a little bit creepy. I mean, you have to admit, that sounds just a little bit creepy. Well, it got me thinking, because by the spring of 06, Shimkus and other members of, informed Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, about this. And it makes you think. You have to ask the obvious question. If this was no big deal, if these were just overly friendly emails, why did they need to inform the leadership? Why did they have to inform the House leader, the leader of the Republican Party for the House of Representatives? If it's not a big deal, they didn't have to tell him. If it's not a big deal, it's not an issue. It leads to the logical question that this was a big deal, and they had to tell the House Speaker. You have to ask from that logical point, why did they do nothing? There had been rumors for years that this guy had been engaging in inappropriate actions with former staffers. And I'm going to read you this part, this little piece here from the Newsweek article. It's called The Wrong Message, and it's, I apologize, I should have mentioned before, it's from the October 9th issue of Newsweek. And this includes this little thing. A former female page who asked not to be identified to protect her privacy told Newsweek that she and other pages had regularly seen Foley stop and talk to pages on the House floor and in the cloakroom, lingering with them and asking them to describe their experiences in Congress. "We just gradually figured out he was flirting with the guys," said the page. "It made a lot of the guys uneasy. He was kind of creepy." That's the type of stuff that was known about. If the pages knew about it, you have to honestly ask yourself, how could the leadership of the page committee, and I have to honestly include all the members that I mentioned, Shimkus, Capito, and Kildee, how could they not know? How could they not know what was occurring if members of the Page staff were aware of this? Now, this has been a rumor for years, and Pages had spoken out about this, and let's get into one basic simple thing. These people are in charge of this committee, and these members of the House basically have a fiduciary duty to these members of the Page staff. And what I mean by fiduciary duty is that they are to hold their rights, their responsibilities over these people above their very own, above everything else, to ensure that their rights, their safety, to ensure that everything goes by fine with them, because they have been entrusted by their parents to live in this dorm, you know, lifestyle, to be, you know, almost free employees for the Congress. And you have to ask that. Why is it that Representative Capito said there's only three of us on the Page board, and I feel that we should have been informed? Well, you're right. You should have been informed. It is your duty. If you have a duty of care in which to investigate these types of things, if rumors have floated throughout the Congress, then you have a right to check that out. It's your responsibility. You're in charge of this program. And as I said, I have to bring this on Representative Kildee, who's a Democrat, because it's only fair. If you are being left out in the loop, you better get yourself back in the loop. That's your job. You're in charge. People have elected you to represent them. Do your job. This goes for all of them. Do your job. You're supposed to protect this. You're supposed to protect them. How is this Congress supposed to protect the country if they cannot protect members of the Congressional Page staff? You have to ask that question. And you also have to ask this question. Why is it that Kirk Fordham, who works for Congressman Reynolds and who used to work for Congressman Foley, why did he work to cut a deal with ABC News to keep this story away from the press? Now, according to Mr. Fordham, and this is from the Los Angeles Times, the story is called Aid at Center of Controversy. Let's see. He asked ABC News to not publish the messages, a protective role Fordham had performed for years as he sought to prevent mainstream media reports about his ambitious boss's sexual orientation. The aide's attempt to ask ABC not to publish or air the instant messages was not an effort to withhold information from law enforcement, a gentleman named Heafy said, Tim Heafy, who was a former federal prosecutor. He claims it was never an attempt to obstruct justice. It was an attempt to shield his boss from a political storm, but that's the whole point. You shouldn't be protecting people like this from a political storm. It is not the liberals, the progressives, or the Democrats that went and immediately politicized this. It was the Republicans. It was the Republicans who tried to keep this information from being aired out to begin with until possibly after the elections. That's the only reason to do this, is because you're trying to protect the power base that you have. And that is what's wrong with that. That is number one of what is wrong with that. Number two of what is wrong with that are people like Matt Drudge and this type of statement.
And if anything, these kids are less innocent. These 16 and 17-year-old beasts, and I've seen what they're doing on YouTube, and I've seen what they're doing all over the internet. And you just have to tune into any part of their pop culture. You're not going to tell me these are innocent babies. Have you read the transcripts that ABC posted going into the weekend of these instant messages back and forth?
So
the kids are egging the congressman on. The kids are trying to get this out of him. We haven't got the whole story on this.
It's okay.
Say, well, Drudge, it's abuse of power. This is a congressman abusing these impressionable young 17-year-old beasts, talking about their sex lives with a grown man on the internet. Because you have to remember, those of us who have seen some of the transcripts of these nasty instant messages, this was two ways, ladies and gentlemen. These kids were playing Foley for everything he was worth. Oh, yeah. Oh, I haven't, they were talking about how many times they've masturbated, and, oh, they didn't do it with their girlfriends this weekend, all this, all these things, and these innocent children. And this poor congressman sitting there typing about, oh, am I going to get any, you know?
If you heard any sounds in the background, the little, you know, sounds that sound like people just being exasperated, I got that clip from the Stephanie Miller show. So that's the sound you hear, is her and her staff who are listening to this and just stunned by what's being said by Mr. Drudge. I also will include a link from Media Matters, which is the full link as to that story, so you can read that as well for yourself. There was also another story that came out, and this is from the Wall Street Journal. And it's called Paging Mr. Hastert, Could a Gay Congressman Be Quarantined? And so I'm going to quote from this. At least this seems to be the essence of the Democratic and media charge against Dennis Hastert, who admits his office was told months ago about a friendly, non-explicit 2005 email exchange between Mr. Foley and another page. Let's see. Some of those liberals now shouting the loudest from Mr. Hastert's head are the same voices who tell us that the larger society must be tolerant of private lifestyle choices and must certainly never leap to the conclusions about gay men and young boys. Are these Democratic critics of Mr. Hastert now saying that they are now have more sympathy for the Boy Scouts' decision to ban gay scoutmasters? Where's Minority Leader Pelosi on that one? You have to respond to these two particular things because it's just disgusting. What Matt Drudge is basically saying is that these 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, you know, they were asking for it. They were sweaty when they were handing me the, you know, that new message. You know, look at the way they're dressed. They're wearing a tie. The tie's looking sexy. You know, that goes way beyond the point. That should not even be the point. We should not be, you know, basically blaming these kids for, it's like, for being there and for allowing this man to do what he did and say it doesn't really matter. That's not the point. Well, that's a pretty god-awful position to take. And for the Wall Street Journal to come out and basically equate being gay with being a pedophiliac is just outrageous, because that's what they're doing. They're equating the two issues. And it doesn't take much to look up and know and understand that people who are, you know, who are pedophiliacs are mostly straight. This guy just happened to be gay. He is gay. It's one of those secrets that, you know, wasn't very well kept. And it's not the issue. The issue was his involvement with former congressional pages who were minors. Now, one of the things that's come out and has been out there on the blog, and I bring it up because of Mr. Drudge's statements, is, you know, because he's saying there's 16 or 17-year-olds who knew what they were doing. They were still minors. And one of the issues that's been coming out is that people are going, well, if you look at the age of consent, anything that he did, this shouldn't be against the law. So I took it upon myself to look up the age of sexual consent laws, and I'll have a link up as well. And in the District of Columbia, because this is the first thing they're going to bring up, is that the age of consent is 16 years old. What they won't mention, and what you should mention back to them, is that there's an addendum to this, which says the age of sexual consent is 16 for adults who are under 30 years of age. Mr. Foley is 52. He is nowhere near this 30-year age limit, and they write this into the law because it is meant to keep people of greater age from using their age, experience, and their power to seduce and abuse that authority over minors. These are still 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds, not old enough to vote, not old enough to serve in the army. They may be old enough to drive, but they are still subject to the same protections that you would want of your children, of your brother, of your sister. And to just say, what does it matter, is really the saddest argument that has been heard of this year or any year to protect somebody. And for the Republican leadership to basically stand up and try to cover this up to protect their power base is sad. I mean, who do these people think they are? Do they think they're the Catholic Church? You know, they're not. I'm tired of politicians thinking they're priests. I'm tired of priests thinking they're politicians. You're supposed to protect people. It's your number one job. You're a lawmaker. Protect them. That's what your job is. And if we go back, and just to give you an idea, because I thought it was important to look up, the age of consent in Louisiana, 17. So if that kid was 16, that's already broken the law. For Florida, where the congressman is from, it's 18. The age of consent issue is a load of crap. I promise you, it is a load of crap. It is meant to quickly deflect the argument. Well, when they try it, when people try it on you, push it back on them. Because here's the truth. If it is D.C., you can now say that that law only works for an adult under the age of 30. Age of consent is not an issue. What is at issue are people doing everything they can to protect their jobs, to protect their jobs, to party over principle, over protecting people. And that is a sad testimony to the Republican Party leadership. That is why people have been asking for Representative Hastert to resign. It is why the representatives that I mentioned who were involved with the Page Committee should resign their post, put somebody else in charge. They had a duty to protect those kids, duty to protect those kids. They failed. They should resign. If they are your representatives, I encourage you to go to, I believe it's Indirect Democracy, has a link on how to contact your representatives in the archive section. If not, just do a Google search. Really, if they're your representative, tell them to resign that particular position. They shouldn't be there. The other thing is, if this is a criminal investigation, and if Mr. Hastert and other members, including Representative Shimkus, Mr. Fordham, and Mr. Reynolds, did everything they could to prevent this from coming out, there is another option the FBI needs to look into. Basically, what they have done in trying to keep this type of information quiet for years now, it really needs to be looked into as well, because that essentially is aiding and abetting a criminal. They had the duty to look into this. They knew something was wrong. And to just sit back and not do anything is negligence. It's possible criminal negligence. And it is also possible, and I say it allegedly because I'm trying to protect myself, it's very well it could possibly be aiding and abetting a criminal and being an accessory after the fact. I don't know if that's what it's going to be, but it puts them in that position. The fact that they allowed themselves to be there is why those members who I've mentioned should resign. Let's see, I'm going to change topics now. And I'm going to try to do as best justice I can to this story, because it is a rather lengthy story, and I encourage you to read it. The title of the story is, Will the Next Election Be Hacked? It's by Bob Kennedy, who, if you are aware and if you're not, wrote a great story just a few months ago for Rolling Stone about the stealing of the 2004 election. This particular story focuses on Diebold and the electronic voting machines, which are the major thesis of this, is that they are very open to the possibility of having the election stolen through computer fraud. I'm going to do my best to give you just a short synopsis and encourage you to go to the link for Indirect Democracy to read this article, because it is an eye-opener. It's the type of thing we all need to think about, because our votes are very much at stake, and as I mentioned before, maybe one of the reasons why the Republicans may not have to worry, and this is not to be conspiratorial, is that there are too many Diebold machines out there that could possibly stand to being hacked. And I'm going to read you some quick little blurbs here from the article. This one deals with Representative Bob Ney, who recently resigned. Actually, I believe he was indicted. The primary author and steward of the Help Americans Vote Act was Bob Ney. GOP chairman of the powerful U.S. House Administration Committee, Ney had close ties to the now disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, whose firm received at least $275,000 from Diebold to lobby for its touchscreen machines. Ney's former chief of staff, David Stefano, also worked as a registered lobbyist for Diebold, receiving at least $180,000 from the firm to lobby for HAVA, or the Help Americans Vote Act. In a clever twist, HAVA effectively pressures every precinct to provide at least one voting device that has no paper trail, supposedly so that vision-impaired citizens can vote in secrecy. The provision was backed by two little-known advocacy groups, the National Federation of the Blind, which accepted $1 million from Diebold to build a new research institute, and the American Association of People with Diabilities, which pocketed at least $26,000 from voting machine companies. When 212 congressmen from both parties sponsored a bill to mandate a paper trail for all votes, Ney used his position as chairman to prevent the measure from even getting a hearing before the committee. The result was that HAVA, the chief reform effort after the 2000 election disaster, placed much of the nation's electoral system in the hands of for-profit companies. For-profit companies. Three of these four companies have close ties to the Republican Party, including Diebold. Their CEO, Walden O'Dell, promised to deliver Ohio's electoral votes to Bush in 2004. That year, Diebold would count in half of would count half the votes, would count the votes in half of Ohio's counties. There was one particular provision. There's another story in this article, so if you want to buy Rolling Stone, you know, check it out. There's another story called Two Judges Slam Ohio, dealing with how Ken Blackwell handled that particular debacle. And also consider writing to your congressman or contacting them, because the secretaries of state who handle the votes for a state should not be in charge of any president's bid for election in that state. I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat. You don't belong in that position. It's too much power, too much leeway in how those votes can go. But here's this one section from page 80. During the 2004 presidential election, with Diebold machines in place across the state, things began to go wrong from the very start. A month before the vote, an abandoned Diebold machine was discovered in a bar in Baltimore. What's really worrisome is that someone can get hold of all the technology for manipulation if they knew the inner workings of just one machine. Election day was a complete disaster. Countless numbers of machines were down because of what appeared to be flaws in Diebold's system, says Hood, who was in charge of a crew of roving technicians charged with making sure that the polls were up and running. Memory cards overloading, machines freezing up, poll workers afraid to turn them on or off for fear of losing votes. Can you believe that? Losing votes. Then, after the polls closed, Diebold technicians who showed up to collect the memory cards containing the votes found that many were missing. The machines are gone, one janitor told Hood, picked up apparently by the vendor who had delivered them in the first place. There was major chaos because there were so many cards missing. It is time to find a way to get back to paper ballots, because we have to have a paper trail, something that will show exactly who we voted for. Any one person, and it's been shown before that these machines can be hacked, votes can be changed, and we need to get back to accountability. This is all this is about, is just getting back to accountability. Our right to vote is one of our most precious, precious things that we have as Americans. Too often we do not vote. It is important to vote. It is important to take part in that grand American tradition, but it is also extremely important to make sure that this type of activity is stopped. Once again, this is where you have to start writing the letters, have to start calling your talk shows, doing everything you can, even if it's talking to friends, to make them aware of this type of activity. Please go to the link. Please read the full article, because I cannot do it justice in the amount of time that is necessary. And it is something that has to change. And this is how we can affect our democracy. And speaking of democracies and affecting them, we have a new sponsor with that in mind, in dealing with educating ourselves about how to vote. Here is our newest sponsor.
Hey, kids! Do you want to play president? Want to know what it takes to get elected? Well, your pals at Sesame Street have become best friends with your friendly neighbors at Diebold to bring you its newest family game. Vote for me, Elmo! Parents, spend hours teaching your kids their right to vote while sharing valuable lessons with your pals like Oscar the Grouch.
Democrats have no solutions.
Elmo just wants to be safe.
Three spaces? I landed on Ohio.
One, two, three votes for the GOP. Ah, ah, ah.
Elmo won't wait 8 hours in line.
My donkey-shaped game piece wants to cut and run. Hey, my elephant wins.
Snuffleupagus is Elmo's best friend, and he's an elephant too.
Vote for me, Elmo, the board game. Electronic voting fun for the whole family by Diebold. Diebold. When it matters most, Diebold knows what really counts.
Let's see. We're going to end off this podcast with the What a Weenie Award. This week's What a Weenie goes to Newsweek magazine. Now, I'm a subscriber to Newsweek, so this kind of pains me. I subscribe to the magazine. I subscribe to the podcast. I go to MSNBC first for my news. before I'll go to CNN, and God forbid if I go to Fox News. So I will admit that over the past few years, I've grown to trust Newsweek as my first and main way to get the news. And I really look forward to getting my Newsweeks and get a little upset with my mailman for not having them there on time. So last week, I received my Newsweek for the week of October 2nd, 2006, and was a little bit surprised to see that on the cover was Annie Leibovitz and an article called My Life in Pictures. Now, I do agree that Miss Leibovitz is one of this generation's greatest photographers. I think she's a fine photographer. And her work, I happen to believe, is one of those few that you can easily recognize the moment you see it, which, you know, is really the marker of a great artist. But to be honest with you, I was a little surprised that that was the cover story. So, to be honest with you, I left it alone. I left it alone until I was listening to Stephanie Miller one day and had heard that Newsweek had different covers for its international readers than it did for its United States readers. And in particular, international readers of Newsweek were given a cover story called Losing Afghanistan, and it had a man holding an RPG. Now, there is the picture of these covers is up at the main site for Indirect Democracy, so if you want to take a look at those pictures, you can. To be fair, my issue of Newsweek for that week has on it Al-Qaeda and Jihadistan, which is in no way comparable to Losing Afghanistan. It just really lacks that punch, and I was really surprised about that. I decided to call Newsweek and find out why there was this discrepancy, and I spoke with somebody there at Subscription Services who had a ready answer to go, so I'm imagining this did become a bit of an issue. The woman was, I say for lack of better terms, was kind enough to inform me, and a little bit terse in her voice, so maybe not so kind, but she told me that the international covers are always different than the U.S. edition. So I checked this week's edition, dated October 9th, and yep, I also will post those pics, but you'll see that the covers for October 9th are different. Ours has the mention of the story for, let's see, State of Denial, which is the new, Bob Woodward book. It's The Price of Denial. And the other ones deal with the losing boom in oil. So they were correct. Their international editions are different from their U.S. editions. And I'm going to admit, I'm not so uninformed to understand that international magazines will have different covers for different regions because different stories affect them in those areas. I think we can all understand that. We can all agree with that. But when all the international covers are exactly the same and the only one that's different is yours, I hate to say it, you feel a sense of betrayal. It makes you feel like we're not smart enough to understand what's going on, or that we're not smart enough to know to be told the truth. It makes you feel that there's truth to the study that the United States ranks somewhere in the 40s as to how free our press is, and it gives that some clarity, you know, that we're not even in the top 10, we're in the top 40. You know, I'm pretty sure there are valid business reasons for putting Annie Leibovitz on the cover, and you know, maybe Newsweek felt that we needed a little bit of levity in our lives. And maybe that type of levity was to let us know that, you know, art and beauty is basically what separates us from that animal-like quality of war. But I still can't shake this thought. The importance of a free press was so important to our founders that in our Constitution, it's the only profession outside of government that's listed within the Constitution. The fact that it's in the First Amendment isn't a coincidence. Our press, essentially, and I can't remember who I heard this from, so I apologize if I can't remember where I was given this wonderful piece of wisdom. Our press, essentially, is the unofficial fourth branch of government that places necessary checks and balances on our government. You know, like I said, maybe there's valid reasons for different cover, but it still doesn't change that overarching feeling that Newsweek not only sold us out, it sold itself out as well. So that is the reason why this week's What a Weenie Award goes to Newsweek magazine. So thank you very much for listening in to this week's episode of Indirect Democracy. If you have any questions or comments, I ask you kindly, not urge, to write to me at david@indirectdemocracy.com. Any ideas for who you might like to see nominated as a What a Weenie? I would love to hear it. And anything you might like to contribute, I'd love to read it as well and read it in this podcast. Let's see. Of course, I would be remiss without thanking Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their music, Not Your Enemy, as the intro and outro for this podcast. You can find their music at www.megaphonemusic.net and at their MySpace account at myspace.com/megaphone. You can also purchase their album at iTunes, and as I mentioned before, I did buy it. Fun album. Just, you know, good old-fashioned rock and roll. So, with that in mind, I want to thank you very much for listening. Be sure to take care of each other. And have a great week, everybody. I will see you next week. Happy birthday, Marc Maron.